Chapter 58.
"I can see everyone," said President Paul Porter, over a secure link from the White House Situation Room. "Are we all on?"
"Yes, Mr. President," replied Lydia Ryan, from a sensitive compartmented information facility, also known as a SCIF at the Carlton Group.
"I'm here," said CIA Director Bob McGee, from his secure conference room at Langley.
"I'm here as well, Mr. President," said Harvath,
over his encrypted connection back at the compound guest house in Brussels. "Okay, let's cut right to the chase," stated Porter. "I reached out to the Italian Prime Minister. He's willing to accept the family in question, but on two conditions. The first is that the Italians do not have to subsidize them. They will grant conditional citizenship for 24 months. Basically, as long as they keep their noses clean, they can stay. The second condition is that whatever intel the head of household provides, it absolutely has to have a link to outing the perpetrators of the Rome attack. How are we on both of those conditions?"
"Mr. President," replied McGee, "as per financial support for the family in question, there is absolutely money in the budget for that. In fact, it would be our desire to make the funding contingent upon his continued cooperation. We would expect him to provide everything, every operation he's ever worked on, every contact he's ever had, every asset, every means of communication, names in the GRU, any military intelligence he may have, etc."
"Understood," said Porter. "What about the second condition?"
"Scott, do you want to take this one?" asked Ryan.
"Sure," he replied. "Mr. President, from what the subject has told me, there is an absolutely straight-line connection to what happened in Rome. If we can get to the next rung on the ladder, we've got the Holy Grail. He has all of the names, dates, places, all of it. We'll not only be able to tell the Italians we got one of the ultimate players, but we should also be in a position to furnish the identities of their own nationals who were involved.
And if we can deliver this intelligence to the Italians, then the same person in question should be able to tell us who was responsible in-country for all the other attacks, so that we can provide our other allies with that information as well."
"That is correct, yes, sir, but with one caveat."
"What's that?" asked Porter.
"Any response needs to be coordinated," stated Ryan. "For instance, we can't have the Italians launching their own campaign while the Norwegians carry out their own separate reprisal. An attack on one member is an attack on all. The response from the alliance should demonstrate absolute unity."
"This is also," added McGee, "an opportunity to repair some of the rifts in the alliance. The bombings in Istanbul have killed nearly 300 people so far. The Turks should be granted a lead role in planning and executing any response."
"Agreed," said the president. "I've been watching the footage. It's beyond horrific. They're calling it Turkey's 9/11. I've already called the president to express America's condolences."
"Absolutely the right thing to do," stated Ryan. "But, sir, if I may?"
"Go ahead."
"As someone who has operated in Turkey and continues to pay attention to their politics, we need to make sure that even though the PRF has claimed credit, the Turkish president doesn't somehow use this as an excuse for more political purges."
"I completely concur," Porter replied. "Right now the Turks are the ones I'm most worried about. Things have gotten to the point, I'm afraid, where no matter what we say, if the Russians contradict it, they'll take Moscow's side. We are going to need absolutely watertight, overwhelming evidence to convince them of who was responsible."
"And we'll get it," replied Harvath. "All we need to do is isolate that next rung on the ladder. That's where it will be."
"Understood. So, what's left? What do you need from me?"
"For the moment, sir," said Ryan, "nothing. Director McGee will work on an extraction plan for the subject's family, while we work on identifying the next rung, as Scott put it, and how to go after it."
"And what's our exposure on Sweden? Am I going to be getting an angry call at some point here from the Prime Minister?"
"I've already reached out to their intelligence director and have taken the hit," McGee responded. "Gunnar wasn't happy. In fact, he was very upset that we didn't give him a heads up. Lars Lund is not going to be easy for them to replace. The police inspector in Visby Hospital, though, will recover. On balance, I think the relationship will be okay, especially now that we can confirm who was behind the Gotland cell and what their mission was."
"Keep monitoring it," instructed Porter. "They're an important partner."
"Yes, sir," Is there anything else?
No, sir,
McGee replied. All right, then, the president declared.
Let me end by stating something I know we all agree on, but I want to make crystal clear. I don't want to see another scene like Rome or Istanbul. Full stop. Is that understood?
There was a chorus of yes, Mr. President, before the video conference was closed. And while Ryan and McGee, by virtue of being back in the States, might have to bear the burden of dealing with Porter face to face, the real weight of his words, and his expectations, fell upon Harvath's shoulders. With that knowledge fully in mind, he exited the guest house and headed back over to the basement of the main building. He had lived up to his end of the bargain. It was time for Ivan Kuznetsov to do the same. And if he didn't, Harvath intended to make clear that even God himself wouldn't be able to protect the Russian or any of the members of his 9-person family.
Chapter 59. Minsk, Belarus. Tomasz Wojcik was sitting in the Crown Plaza's trendy Empire restaurant, enjoying the view over the city, when Pavel Kushner arrived. He was carrying a large black leather briefcase, similar to what pilots carried.
"You should have started without me," said Kushner as he sat down.
"I did," Wojcik replied. "You're late. I finished eating a half hour ago."
The Belarusian smiled. His friend had gotten curmudgeonly in his old age. He probably wasn't having enough sex. He should have taken him up on his offer to arrange a girl for him. A young lady of lower social responsibility would have helped reinvigorate his manhood.
"Did you have the buffet?" asked Kushner. "Or did you order off the menu?"
"I had a hard-boiled egg, toast, and coffee," the Pole replied matter-of-factly.
"You know what?" his friend replied, eyeing the nearby buffet. "I really think retirement agrees with you. You were much more uptight in the old days."
Wojcik wasn't in the mood. Both of the nights that he had been in the hotel, he had slept like crap. The first night was because his room had been right next to the elevators, which had chimed all night long. And the second night, after they had moved him, there'd been a bunch of drunks stumbling up and down his floor. He couldn't wait to get out of Minsk and back to Poland.
"So, what do you have for me?" he asked.
"I'll tell you in a moment," said Kushner. "First, I need to get some breakfast. I'm starving."
The Pole almost couldn't believe it. His friend had arrived almost an hour late and now wanted him to wait while he hit the buffet.
"By all means," Wojcik replied. "Take your time."
His facetiousness was completely lost on the man. Watching as he quickly walked over to the buffet, he had to wonder if Pavel was actually hungry, or if he was just eager to chat up the very large-breasted woman picking up berries, one at a time, with a pair of tongs and daintily placing them on a small white plate. Signaling the waitress, the Pole politely requested more coffee. He looked at his watch and tried to figure out how long it would take to get home if he was able to leave in the next half hour. Depending on traffic, it was a 7 to 8 hour drive. Kopech had forbidden him to fly. Customs at the Minsk airport was much tougher than at the vehicle border crossing. Since their meeting Saturday night in Gorky Park, his psoriasis had only gotten worse. No matter how much ointment he applied, it wasn't getting any better. In fact, it had spread. He really needed to decrease his stress. Pulling out his phone, he searched for the nearest drugstore. He would pick up some petroleum jelly and slather his affected skin before leaving. He hoped that would provide enough relief for him to withstand the uncomfortable drive home.
"Did you see that woman in the knit dress?" Kushner asked as he sat down, his plate piled high with eggs, pancakes, and bacon.
"How could anyone miss her?"
"She's from Babrusk. You know what they say about women from Babrusk."
"Actually, in Warsaw, we don't talk about women from Babrusk that often. In fact, it's probably closer to never. Can we get on with our business, please?"
"My dear Tomasz," Kushner replied, what good is all the money we made and all the risks we took if we cannot enjoy ourselves?
Pavel, we have known each other for many years, so I hope you'll appreciate my being comfortable enough with you to be frank. Knock off the bullshit. Do you have something for me or not?
What I have is a prediction for you. Within a year, unless you loosen up, you will be in a retirement home.
The Pole shook his head.
Of all the meetings I have ever had, this is the one I should have brought a gun to. You better have more than just a prediction in that briefcase, old friend.
Kushner smiled.
Would I disappoint you, old friend? He asked,
opening the case to show him what was inside.
Wojcik removed the file folder from his own briefcase and compared the pictures Kopech had given him to what he was now looking at. It was a perfect match. Kushner appeared to have secured the components from one of the upgrade kits.
Where did you get that?
The Belarusian shrugged.
It wasn't difficult, I told you. There are only a few people in Belarus who could handle something like this.
Where are the rest of the kits?
They're safe.
I paid you $100,000 to locate them, said the Pole.
Which I did, Kushner replied. I even brought one here to prove it to you. If you have a buyer interested in the entire lot, I'd be happy to let my source know.
Wojcik looked at him.
So now you're the broker on this deal?
As far as you're concerned,
yes. Who has the upgrade kits?
My dear Tomasz, it would be highly unethical of me to divulge that information, said the Belarusian.
Wojcik felt a wave of nausea coming over him. Kopech was going to be extremely angry at this development. Taking a deep breath, he tried to remain calm.
How about this? Let's go downstairs to my room. I'll take a few photographs of the merchandise, contact my client, and we'll take things from there.
Can I finish my breakfast first? Asked Kushner.
Bring it with you, replied the Pole,
removing several bills from his wallet and placing them on the table.
I'll carry the case.
Picking up his plate and his coffee cup, Kushner followed Wojcik to the elevator and down to his room. There, Wojcik produced a small digital camera and took pictures of the components from every conceivable angle. When he was finished, Kushner shoveled the last bite of food into his mouth, repacked the equipment into his briefcase, and headed for the door.
Wait a second, said Wojcik. Where are you going?
If your client is interested, you know how to reach me, Kushner replied. Thanks for breakfast.
Leaving the room, the Belarusian was careful to make sure that he wasn't being followed. He had been warned that Wojcik likely had a tail. As he disappeared into the stairwell, a man stepped out of a doorway at the other end of the hall. Seeing that the Pole's visitor had left, he removed his encrypted cell phone and composed a message. Oleg Tretyakov would want to know everything that had happened.
Chapter 60. Entering Lithuanian airspace. Harvath's plan wasn't simple. In fact, it was quite complicated. That meant there were a lot of ways in which it could go wrong. According to Kuznetsov, Colonel Oleg Tretyakov was in Kaliningrad. Similar to the Vatican's being its own state within Italy, Kaliningrad was an exclave, sovereign Russian territory, a mini-country cut off from Russia, right inside Europe. Sandwiched in between NATO members Poland and Lithuania, Kaliningrad was tightly controlled and nearly impossible to get into. And based on what Kuznetsov had revealed, it would be doubly difficult for Harvath. Kuznetsov had recognized him back on Gotland because of the CCTV footage Johansson had recovered from Visby Hospital. That footage had been forwarded to Tretyakov and had likely been added to every Russian database. The moment Harvath tried to access any Russian-controlled port of entry and his photograph or facial scan was run, he'd be taken into custody and the GRU alerted. That meant the only way he could get into Kaliningrad was to sneak in. He had thought about somehow smuggling the team in via trucks, but the Kaliningrad crossings resembled those at the U.S.-Mexico border. There was a heavy dog presence at each one, and they had no problem holding people up for hours as they went vehicle by vehicle looking for anything out of the ordinary. The situation along the exclave's rugged coastline wasn't any better. As Kaliningrad was home to Russia's Baltic fleet, the surface and subsurface patrols were extensive and around the clock. With land and sea options out of the question, that left only one other possibility: air. The plan was to conduct a high-altitude, low-opening, or HALO, parachute jump. They would exit the aircraft over Lithuanian airspace and glide for several kilometers, popping their chutes and landing in a predetermined location in the Kaliningrad countryside. From there, they would make their way into the city and search for Tretyakov. Everything up to that point was the easy part. Getting out of Kaliningrad was going to be something else entirely. Harvath had no idea how they were going to pull that off. The last big exfiltration he had done had been via high-speed boats out of Libya. Their navy was easy to avoid, and had they been forced to, even easier to outrun. The Russians, though, were in a completely different league. It was said that it could take even longer to get out of Kaliningrad than to get in. Waits for exiting the country could run as long as 5 or more hours. It was why citizens of Kaliningrad preferred taking the buses, which have their own lanes at the borders. On top of the problem of how they were going to get out, Harvath also had to plan for what they'd do if a member of the team were injured or captured, or if the authorities became aware of their presence and there was a tightening at the borders and an exclave-wide manhunt. The sheer impossibility of it all was almost overwhelming. It reminded Harvath of the beginnings of the OSS and the incredibly dangerous assignments its teams were sent on behind enemy lines. But at least when they jumped into foreign countries, they had local partisans on the ground whom they could link up with and get help from. That wouldn't be the case in Kaliningrad. As soon as Harvath and his team touched the ground, they'd be on their own. They'd have to secure their own transportation, do their own reconnaissance, and avoid detection every step of the way. With the OSS in mind, Harvath decided to reapproach his problem. How would they have handled it? While they were tough as hell, and when forced, underwent some amazingly grueling treks, they had always looked for the simplest answer first. If an ounce of courage could prevent a pound of hardship, they had gone the courage route. The easiest places at which to cross over were the designated border checkpoints. Because Jasinski was Polish military intelligence, and because they might be coming in hot, he wanted to exit Kaliningrad into Poland, where she not only spoke the language, but also commanded some authority. With that in mind, he studied the 5 Poland-Kaliningrad crossings. Starting at the Baltic Sea, he went one by one, heading east. For the most part, they were practically interchangeable. They all cut through flat, open rural farmland. Not exactly ideal terrain for a covert crossing. But the very last easternmost checkpoint was different. In the Varmian-Masurian province was the county of Goldup. A third the size of Gotland, its population was only slightly larger than that of the town of Visby. It was bordered by the Sheshkia Hills on one side and the Rominska Forest on the other, and running parallel to its border crossing was a nice long lake. A third of it was on the Russian side of the border, and the other 2/3 were on the Polish side. The minute Harvath saw it, he knew that was how they were getting out of Kaliningrad. And as if he needed a sign that he had picked the right spot, when he saw the Rominska Forest running down the eastern side of the lake, it rang a bell with him. Hermann Göring, the corpulent Nazi who oversaw the creation of the dreaded Gestapo and was a prime OSS target, had built a hunting lodge in Rominska. At one point, the second most powerful man in Germany, Göring was sentenced to death by hanging at Nuremberg, but cheated the hangman by ingesting a cyanide capsule. Of all the things Göring was infamous for, plundering the art of Jewish Holocaust victims, as well as art from museums across Europe, had ranked him at the top of the OSS's Art Looting Investigation Unit's red flag list. From France alone, it was reported that over 25,000 railroad cars of stolen art and treasure had been shipped to Germany. His personal collection had been valued at more than $200 million. Goering's lodge in the Raminska, where he was believed to have showcased some of his stolen artwork, was known as the Reichsjägerhof Raminten. It served as his headquarters during Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis attacked and invaded the Soviet Union. Harvath would have liked to have been around to have seen Goering's beloved lodge burned to the ground. As it was, he'd have to take pleasure in sticking it to the Russians by using the lake for their escape. On the western shore of the Polish side was a hotel and health spa. Because half his team would be needed to help coordinate their exfil, and because half were not HALO certified, Harvath decided that's where they would be based. As guests of the hotel, they would have the perfect cover for exploring the lake and the areas around it. With that settled, Harvath sat down with Haney and began to make an extensive list of everything the operation would require. He started with how much gear each team member could jump into Kaliningrad with, and then worked on honing it down to what was absolutely essential. It was going to be a bitch pulling the equipment together from various American military outposts in the region, but if anyone could make it happen, it was Haney. He was, of course, disappointed not to be going into Kaliningrad, even though he was HALO qualified. He had suffered a leg injury during their assignment in Libya, and the team couldn't risk his re-injuring it on the jump. Yashinsky wasn't qualified, so she'd be staying back with Haney as part of the exfil element. Because of the water component involved in their escape, Harvath wanted Barton, a SEAL, to stay back and make sure all of it went off without a hitch. The trio had already been dropped at Olsztyn Mazury Airport, near the village of Szymany. Their portion of the gear would be flown in via a military transport plane. Once it arrived, they would hook the trailers up to the SUVs they had rented and drive to their hotel on Lake Goldup. Inserting with Harvath into Kaliningrad would be Ashby, Stalin, and Palmer. Morrison and Gage had remained back in Brussels with Nicholas to guard the compound and keep an eye on Kuznetsov until a CIA security team arrived to fly him into Landstuhl Medical Center for treatment. Harvath would have preferred to be going into Kaliningrad with more operators, but the bigger their footprint, the greater their visibility. Four would have to do. As the Gulfstream jet made its final approach into Šiauliai International Airport in Lithuania, Harvath went through everything again. He wanted every possible angle nailed down before they launched, and they needed to launch as soon as possible. Not only was President Porter anxious for them to get to Tretyakov, but there was also the concern that Swedish intelligence could cover up what had happened on Gotland for only so long. At some point, Kuznetsov was going to miss a communications window, and the GRU was going to get suspicious. Did that mean Tretyakov would move or go into hiding? Harvath didn't know, but he also didn't want to find out. The sooner they got into Kaliningrad, the sooner they could get to him, and the sooner they could get out. This operation had Harvath concerned on a variety of different levels, not the least of which was the speed at which it was moving. And when you were moving at such high speed, the slightest mistake could turn into the deadliest of events. Chapter 61. Šiauliai, Lithuania. Šiauliai International Airport had once been one of the largest military air bases in the Soviet Union. Now it was home to NATO's Baltic Air Policing Mission. It provided for the rapid scrambling of fighter jets and other aircraft to help protect the airspace over Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. As Harvath dropped the air stairs of the Gulfstream, he saw a familiar face waiting for him out on the tarmac. "Sveiki atvykę!" shouted Carl Pedersen over the sound of the engines winding down. "Welcome to Lithuania!" The Norwegian was dressed in a turtleneck and a pair of well-pressed trousers. He didn't look at all like the man who had raced to find a plane and landed only an hour earlier. Harvath descended the air stairs and shook his hand.
"Good to see you, Carl. Thank you for doing this."
"Where would America be without Norway?" he replied with a smile.
Then, motioning to the man next to him, he said, "May I introduce Philip Landsbergis of the VSD, Lithuania's State Security Department?"
"It's a pleasure to meet you."
Landsbergis was a tall man in his early 40s with blonde hair and green eyes. He wore a barber coat over a gray suit and a simple navy tie. His handshake was firm.
"We appreciate your hosting us," said Harvath.
"Technically, this is a simple NATO rotation," the Lithuanian said, smiling. His English was excellent. "Planes take off, planes land. Who's to say what happens when they're in the air?"
Harvath smiled back.
"Understood."
He pointed to a waiting van. "When your team is ready, we have an area set up where they can refresh themselves and wait for the rest of your equipment to arrive. In the meantime, I have reserved a secure meeting room where we can discuss some of the additional items you have requested. My car is this way." Pedersen joined him, and they followed Landsbergis to his vehicle. The drive across the airbase only took a couple of minutes. They arrived at a long two-story Soviet-era building. Even with the landscaping improvements that had been made outside, nothing could detract from how ugly the structure was. The VSD operative parked his car near the front and led his guest through two glass doors into the lobby. Their meeting room was halfway down a fluorescently lit corridor to the right. Landsbergis punched a code into a worn keypad. The lock released, and he held the door open so Harvath and Pedersen could enter first. He flipped on all the lights and walked over to a small minibar.
"I can offer you coffee, mineral water, or Coca-Cola. Anyone interested?"
"Do you have anything stronger?" asked Pedersen.
"Not here, I'm afraid. I could make a call if you'd like."
"No, don't go to the trouble. Coffee is fine, thank you."
"And for you?" the Lithuanian asked.
"Coffee for me too, please,"
Harvath replied, stepping over to the windows. They offered an impressive view over the entire airbase.
"Didn't the Soviets base many of their long-range bombers here during the Cold War?"
"They did indeed. This was one of only six airfields that could accommodate the Miasishev M4.
"The Bison," said Harvath,
using the NATO designator for the aircraft.
"Capable of reaching the United States but not getting back to the Soviet Union. For a long time, though, the Russians sure had everyone fooled."
"The bomber gap," Pedersen stated, nodding. "The West was worried that the Soviets were building hundreds upon hundreds of these amazing jet-powered strategic bombers. In the end, it was all just a hoax."
"An appropriate metaphor for the Soviet Union itself," declared Landsbergis, as he finished pouring three mugs of coffee and carried them over to the conference table. Harvath agreed. Stepping away from the windows, he joined the two men and took a seat. The VSD operator's laptop was already connected to a projector in the center of the table. Powering it up, he waited for his presentation to load.
"As Carl said, I represent the Lithuanian State Security Department. Even though I am a few years younger, he and I have been friends and colleagues for some time. The Norwegian Intelligence Service has done many favors for the VSD, and I hope you have found that we have always generously reciprocated."
Pedersen nodded.
"American intelligence has also been helpful to Lithuania," he continued, "and we are very grateful for both relationships. In that spirit, we'd like to help you in any way we can. We are extremely concerned about the prospect of a Russian invasion. Currently, Lithuania is undergoing a savage Kremlin-backed disinformation campaign meant to sow discord and weaken our country. Our fear that this may be a prelude to war has been discussed between America's UN ambassador and ours. It is the express opinion of the United States that we should not change our military posture for fear of tipping off or provoking Moscow. We understand this position. That being the case, we do not wish to sit idly by and wait to see what happens. America is our friend, an ally. We also believe we should be involved in any fight that helps to protect and preserve Lithuania. Obviously, we cannot do this in any overt official capacity. If the Russians discovered that we had assisted, that could serve as a severe provocation and goad them into war. Anything we do will have to be covert and off-book. But rest assured that I understand fear is a two-way street. As we fear the Russians learning about our involvement with you, You fear the Russians learning about your involvement with us, and subsequently your mission into Kaliningrad. While I'd like to believe that the Lithuanian State Security Department hasn't been penetrated by Moscow, history and common sense would suggest otherwise. No one in the VSD but me will know the details of your plans, and even then, for operational security, I will not know everything. The Lithuanian took a pause as Harvath looked at Pedersen.
Without him, said the Norwegian, I don't think you have a chance. With him, 50-50, maybe even 60-40.
Actually, clarified Landsbergis, based on what Carl has explained to me that you need, I think we can help improve your odds even more.
Show me what you have in mind,
replied Harvath, as he sat back in his chair, raised his mug, and took a sip. The VSD operative directed his attention to the front of the room and activated the first slide in his presentation. Chapter 62.
1 minute,
the jumpmaster at the ramp of the brand new C-130J Super Hercules yelled to Harvath. The aircraft was part of the 86th Airlift Wing at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. Under authorization from United States European Command, the heavy-duty transport plane had been loaded with a very expensive and very specific shopping list of gear and flown to an airbase in Lithuania. There, four Americans had been standing on the tarmac waiting to meet it. When the aircraft came to a stop, they quickly climbed aboard and kicked the tires of every piece of gear that had been shipped to them. The American team leader bought dinner for everyone, and then spent a good 2 hours with the crew going over weather conditions, wind speeds aloft, altitude calculations, and other equations. He was one of the most thorough customers they had ever given a ride to.
30 seconds,
the jumpmaster yelled. The team had already double-checked each other's gear, and then had checked again. Standing at the ramp with their wingsuits, low-vis helmets, night-vision goggles, and oxygen masks, they looked spooky. Like four dark superheroes out of some post-apocalyptic comic book.
10 seconds,
the jumpmaster yelled. They were all assembled near the edge of the ramp now. The wind was practically deafening, and it was much colder than it had been a few feet back. Technically, they were about to jump into Russia. Harvath raised his gloved fist and gave everyone a bump. He'd be the last one out in case anything went wrong. Ashby would go first, followed by Palmer, then Stalin, and finally Harvath. Had they clumped together, they might have created a significant radar signature. So instead, they were to take different glide paths to the same broad drop zone. In their packs, they carried suppressed pistols, radios, individual med kits, a ton of cash, maps, and some compact, very high-tech equipment. President Porter, Bob McGee, and Lydia Ryan had wanted to ensure that they were as self-sufficient as possible.
On the green,
the jumpmaster yelled, pointing to the light near the ramp.
On the green!
Harvath glanced one last time at the infrared lights on the backs of everyone's helmets. They were all working. He'd be able to track them all the way down.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
shouted the jumpmaster as the light turned green.
Go! Go! Go!
One by one, the team dove headfirst off the ramp at the rear of the aircraft and tumbled through the bitterly cold night sky. Quickly righting themselves, they extended their limbs, spread-eagled, and began to glide. Harvath, like the other team members, watched the computer strapped to his wrist. It provided a range of important data, including altitude, speed, direction, and distance to target. He had jumped with a wingsuit a handful of times before, but had done so in relatively controlled environments without much gear. The added weight they were now all required to carry had been a big source of back and forth with the flight crew as they tried to decide where and when to greenlight the team to jump. Sailing through the moonless pitch black, the only thing Harvath could see through his NVGs were the lights on his team's helmets as they floated through the darkness ahead of him. Per the course they had charted, they anticipated being in Lithuanian airspace for several minutes before they crossed into Kaliningrad's. Looking at his wrist, he did a quick bit of math.
There'd be an alarm reminding them when to pop their chutes, but he didn't want to depend on a computer. That wasn't how the OSS would have done it. Adjusting his trajectory, he continued to glide. There was absolutely no other feeling in the world like it. He continued to check his speed, stunned at how fast they were moving. The pilots had said there would be a favorable wind, but this was amazing. A minute and a half later, he looked at his wrist and saw they were about to cross into Russian airspace. Ahead, he could see each helmet already curving left. They were all precisely following the flight path. According to NATO analysis, there was a gap in Kaliningrad's radar system. By hitting it one at a time, they could slip through the crack without anyone knowing. Harvath followed their lead and adjusted his course to match. The altimeter spun wildly, like a countdown clock on speed. The drop zone was coming up fast. They had picked a spot that looked good, but that could have, for all they knew, belonged to some trigger-happy Russian farmer. According to the Lithuanians, it was a rotating livestock pasture that wasn't currently being used. Giving his altitude and location one last check, he flared his wingsuit to help reduce his speed and popped his chute. The large black canopy burst into the air and unfurled above him. He grabbed the toggles and steered himself in just as the alarm on his wrist computer vibrated. Below him, he marked the positions and speeds of everyone else. All of their chutes appeared to have deployed, and they were expertly navigating the final distance to the ground. Just before he reached the grass, he pulled down on the toggles and flared his chute, slowing himself down as he had done with the wingsuit. Bending his knees, he touched down and jogged forward to dissipate the energy of his landing. It was textbook, perfect even. As his canopy collapsed behind him, he did a quick visual check to make sure everyone else had landed safely. They had. Wriggling out of his harness, he felt something soft underfoot. Looking down, he saw what it was. Cow shit. Fresh cow shit. The pasture wasn't out of rotation, it was in use, and recently so. That was a bad piece of intelligence from the Lithuanians. He prayed it would be the only one. Chapter 63. Washington, D.C. They met at the Rigsby Bar in the Carlisle Hotel at DuPont Circle. Ryan wore an emerald-toned dress that matched her eyes. Kopech wore a black, ill-fitting suit that matched his mood.
"I'll have a Manhattan, please," she said, as the waitress took her order and disappeared.
Kopech, as was his habit, had arrived before her and had started without her. He had been halfway through his second cocktail when she entered the bar. Though it was only a few years old, the Rigsby looked as if it had been around since the 1940s. With its forest-green walls, old-school furniture, and keyhole entryway, it was a passage back to a bygone era. A plate of sardines sat on the table, and Kopech nudged it forward, indicating Ryan should help herself.
"I'm fine, thank you," she replied.
"That must be how you stay so skinny."
He was maudlin. The booze was probably part of it, but there was something else going on.
"What do you have for me, Artur?" she asked.
Removing his phone, he pulled up a series of photographs and slid the phone across the table to her. Ryan scrolled through the photos.
"Where did you get these?"
"My contact in Belarus was able to access one of the kits," he said.
Technically, it was his contact's contact, but she didn't need to know that.
"That's wonderful. Where are the rest of them?"
"Somewhere near Minsk, we believe."
"All of them?"
The Polish intelligence officer nodded.
"This is very good news. Who has control of them?" she asked.
"We don't know. They're using a cutout, a middleman."
"Then how do we get them back?"
"You must purchase them."
Ryan glared at him.
"Purchase them?" she snapped. "The hell we will. Those are property of the United States government. We're not paying someone to give us back what's rightfully ours."
"You don't have an alternative."
"Like hell I don't. I'll send a team in and we'll take them back ourselves."
"A paramilitary team?
On a direct action assignment?
Yes, she replied. Exactly.
Kopech shook his head sadly.
I paid you a lot of money to track those kits down, Artur. It wasn't your job to set up a purchase.
Pausing, she then asked,
Are you trying to rip us off? Because if you are, I promise you, we're going to have a big problem.
Lydia, please. Of course not, he protested. The kits were stolen and now they're in the hands of another party who wishes to sell them.
I want the identity of the cutout.
The Polish intelligence officer threw up his hands.
Why? He's not going to reveal his source.
You don't know that. We could buy him off. It'd be cheaper than buying our merchandise back.
And then what? Steal the kits? Maybe kill the person or persons who have them?
You don't need to concern yourself with what happens next.
He's my source, Lydia. He'd be as good as dead. You don't understand how things work in Belarus.
To tell you the truth, Artur, I don't care. I want those kits back, damn it.
In the entire time he had known her, he didn't think he had ever heard her swear before. Granted, the United States had to be losing its collective mind over the issue, but the stress really seemed to be getting to Ryan. It was time to lay his cards on the table.
There might be one scenario under which I would be willing to give you my source.
Ryan, whose Manhattan had just arrived, was about to take a sip.
Name it,
she said.
You must give me Matterhorn.
Jesus Christ, Artur, how many times do I have to tell you? I don't have him. I don't know who he is. I don't know where he is. Only Reed Carlton knows, and he's not exactly in any shape to talk.
Or so you say.
Her eyes went wide.
You don't believe me?
I'd like to see him for myself.
And I explained to you why that wasn't possible. He has been classified as a risk to national security. This isn't like visiting the old folks' home, having a cup of tea and a sweet chat, then leaving. He is in bad shape, and he could say anything.
I'm willing to risk it.
Ryan laughed.
You're willing to risk it? That's cute. These are American secrets, and American national security we're talking about, not Polish.
Matterhorn is a matter of Polish national security, as far as Poland is concerned.
A long, cold silence fell over the table. Ryan picked up her cocktail and sipped from it, trying to decide what to say. What Kopech did next, though, stunned her. Standing up, he placed a $100 bill on the table.
When you're ready to get serious about your upgrade kits, you know how to reach me.
Don't do this to me, Artur, she implored.
But it was no use. Without so much as goodbye, the Polish intelligence officer turned and left the bar.
Chapter 64. Kaliningrad. After burying their parachutes and wingsuits, Harvath and his team spent the rest of the night in an abandoned barn on an adjacent property. Their weapons loaded and hot, they took turns on watch. Harvath went first. As everyone else settled into sleep, he found a spot that allowed him to observe the dirt road outside. Settling into a comfortable position, he reached into his med kit, grabbed several anti-inflammatory pills, and swallowed them down. Halo jumps were always painful. It didn't matter how much he tried to slow down by flaring his wingsuit. When the canopy unfurled and the drag kicked in, there was an instant snap that shocked the body, like a dog who decides to chase a cat and doesn't know he's on a tether until he reaches the end of it. It hurt like a son of a bitch. Outside the barn, Stalin had rigged a perimeter of IR security cameras that would alert them to any approach. The feeds were accessible via a tablet that Harvath was using to review their limited mission intelligence. From an information perspective, this was an incredibly bare-bones operation. Kuznetsov had told them where Tretyakov lived and worked. He had also provided some information about his routine and potential likes and dislikes. Very little of it was actionable, but what there was, Harvath had decided to act upon. The GRU colonel was single. He had no known girlfriend or boyfriend.
It was not known if he had any pastimes, any hobbies, or any vulnerabilities such as drinking, prostitutes, drugs, or gambling. For their purposes, he was a black hole. Harvath had done more with less before, but that didn't mean he liked it. In a perfect world, you would set up surveillance on the target for weeks, if not months. You would study his every move, learn all of his habits. You would know him better than anyone else. You would know his hopes, his fears, his dreams, and his weaknesses. And by doing this, you would learn the best and most effective place to hit him, some place that was routine in his day, some place where he felt safe, some place where he felt invisible and could let his guard down. There was only one place outside home and work that Kuznetsov could remember Tretyakov having a fondness for. It wasn't a bar, a restaurant, or even a specialty tobacconist. It was an island, almost dead center in the middle of the city, accessed by a bridge covered in padlocks. Kuznetsov had met his GRU superior for a meeting there once. He had remembered Tretyakov remarking that it was within walking distance of his apartment and his office, and that it was where he went when he needed to think.
If only there was a way to force him, to stress him out enough that he would retreat to the island to think, Harvath had reflected.
But a trip to a pretty park somewhere to gather your thoughts was too random. It wasn't like seeing a mistress or visiting a grave on an anniversary. There was no telling how long they could wait for something like that to happen. They would have to pick another place, and they would have to be creative. Every cautious, well-thought-out, well-reasoned, normal thing you would do in a situation like this was out the window. Harvath was convinced, though, that if they could avoid the gravitational pull of chaos, if they could stay outside the boundaries of Murphy's Law, if they could do that just long enough, they might be able to get the job done. They passed the night without incident. Before sunrise, they were dressed like tourists, with backpacks, maps, and cameras waiting to get picked up. They ate a cold breakfast of water and protein bars. When it was time to move, Harvath gave the signal. Despite the mistaken report of the status of the cow pasture drop zone, Philip Landsbergis of the VSD had provided some valuable assistance. A quarter of a mile away, a Lithuanian semi-truck, importing a refrigerated trailer full of fresh fruit and vegetables, sat by the side of the road waiting for them. Its driver, a gruff man immune to pleasantries, told Harvath and his team to hurry up and get in. Russian patrols were random and all over the place. He likened Kaliningrad to a police state. You never knew where or when you'd be forced to deal with the authorities. They did as he asked and climbed inside. The temperature felt to be in the 30s. He pointed out a stack of blankets and a power strip for charging any devices before he closed and locked the door. The team broke out their headlamps and helped themselves to fresh apples and oranges as Stalin recharged the IR cameras and tablet. The ride would be a couple of hours. Grabbing one of the blankets, Harvath found a place he could stretch out and tried to catch up on his sleep. With everything they had in front of them, this would very likely be the last real chance he had. Chapter 65. On the outskirts of Kaliningrad's capital city, the truck pulled over and the driver opened the rear doors. He handed Harvath an envelope with tickets for the tram and then told his passengers to get lost. "Nice guy," said Stalin, as they watched him close up the trailer, hop back into the cab, and pull away.
"That nice guy's father, two uncles and grandfather, were forest brothers," said Harvath,
referencing the Baltic partisans who organized a resistance movement and waged guerrilla warfare against the Soviet occupation throughout World War II and after. "And he comes from great stock," Stalin added, upgrading his assessment of the man.
"He's also our ride out of here," said Harvath.
"My respect for him continues to grow."
"As it should," said Harvath, putting his game face on. "Okay, listen up, everybody. We are deep in Indian country, and there is no cavalry. We have one job, and it is to snatch Tretyakov and get him into Poland. Anything less than that is mission failure. Do you understand me?"
One by one they nodded. All of them understood.
"Good. See you at the rally point. Let's go.
With that, they broke into teams and went in separate directions. Ashby and Stalin headed south. Harvath and Palmer headed west.
What's the plan? The young operative asked, as Harvath checked his map and decided the best route to take.
Well, said Harvath, at the most basic level, we were hired to kill people and blow things up. But let's see if we can avoid that this time. We've managed to get in without anyone knowing. If we can get the job done and get out the same way, this will have been a major success.
Chase pretended to make check marks on an imaginary pad. So that's no fun, no fun, and no fun.
Funny how you can't spell paycheck without no fun.
Actually, Chase began, but Harvath interrupted him.
Our tram is coming. Put your earbuds in and follow me.
Chase did as he was told, and they caught the main tram heading into downtown Kaliningrad. Wearing earbuds was an operational habit they had gotten into. Not only were they able to talk to each other, but it helped them tune out the locals. As long as it looked as if they were listening to music or chatting on the phone, no one attempted to engage them. They rode the tram into downtown and got off near a former Nazi underground bunker that had been turned into a museum. On foot, they headed for Tretyakov's neighborhood. As they walked together, Harvath took the opportunity to train Chase, pointing out CCTV cameras to avoid, places to shake a hypothetical tail, and spots where you could dispose of evidence or hide items and come back to get them later. He had spent a lot of time working with Sloan, but not as much with Chase. It felt good to be in the field with him, to see how he operated in a foreign environment, how he reacted to unusual input. For the most part, he was fantastic. He knew his stuff, and he was incredibly observant. He still, though, got things wrong, and Harvath knew exactly why. Like Sloan, he was smart, funny, and incredibly talented. But also like Sloan, he was still green. Despite all his combat deployments, all his time behind a trigger, there was still an immaturity to him, and he wore it like a beacon pinned to his chest. Killing bad guys, be they Mujahideen, hijackers, warlords, or drug kingpins, was one thing. Blending into a normal everyday scene, as he was doing right now, killing high-profile targets, professional assassins, and unassuming ex-military bodyguards was something completely different. Chase was exceptional at taking out unsophisticated killers, but now he had to become the best at taking out sophisticated ones. The West was under attack, and it was full of them. The war was changing. He and Sloan were the future. So was Yashinsky, if she was truly on board. When they got to Tretyakov's apartment building, Chase asked, "What now?"
"Now," Harvath replied, "we keep walking. No matter what happens, you never stop in front of a target."
They kept going until they arrived at a corner with a small German cafe serving breakfast. Before the Soviets had invaded in the 1940s, Kaliningrad had been part of Prussia. Today, German tourists were a huge part of their economy, and there was a cafe, bar, or restaurant catering to them in every neighborhood, if not on every block.
"How's your German?"
Harvath asked as they took a table outside with a view of Tretyakov's building.
"Terrible?"
"I've got this then," said Harvath,
as a smiling waitress came over with menus and coffee. Smiling back, he spoke to her in his passable Russian, but added a German accent. He sounded like a tourist attempting to speak the local language. The waitress humored him. She asked where he was staying, and, having done his homework, he was able to cite a nearby neighborhood and talk about renting an apartment via a popular internet app. As they drank their coffee, the pair looked for other places they might use for surveillance. They could only sit here for so long without drawing attention. Chase pointed out a boarded-up building down the block. By the looks of it, its roof might have a halfway decent view. More important, it would allow them to get off the street. According to Kuznetsov, Tretyakov liked to walk to work. The last thing they needed was to bump into him, especially since he might recognize Harvath. Once their food arrived, they ate
and paid their bill. The sooner they were out of sight, the better. What's more, Harvath was eager to get a closer look at Tretyakov's apartment. He was starting to form a plan, which he hoped would allow them to snatch the GRU operative without anyone even knowing he was gone. Chapter 66. Harvath and Palmer entered the abandoned building by removing a board from one of the rear windows and headed all the way upstairs. The roof, as they had hoped, had a decent though partly obstructed view of Tretyakov's apartment. Sending out a text, they told Stalin and Ashby where to find them. Then they set up a small camera and took turns watching the ebb and flow of people, hoping to find a pattern. Unfortunately, there was nothing special or predictable about any of the traffic. They saw Babushka, a little old woman who was likely the custodian, go in and come out several times from the building, sweeping and handling other menial labor chores. In the Soviet days, babushkas were often informants who gladly passed on even the slightest pieces of gossip to the authorities. They were quick to report any unusual activity. She would need to be avoided. And while she probably had keys to all the apartments, Harvath wasn't interested. He could get into them without her. What he needed was information. What time did Tretyakov normally leave? What time did he normally come home? Did he entertain during the week? Did he own a vehicle? All they had was where he lived, where he worked, and an outdated photo Nicholas had been able to uncover. "Got him," Chase suddenly said. Harvath, who had been preparing to burst an encrypted sitrep back to the United States, looked over the edge of the roof. In his suit and overcoat, with a leather briefcase slung from his shoulder, he looked every inch the unassuming businessman or government worker. He paused for a moment on the sidewalk, chatting amiably with the babushka, who had followed him outside with a piece of mail. He smiled at the old woman, but his eyes swept the street, scanning for anything unusual or out of place. He was alert but relaxed, about to conduct his morning ritual of walking to work. "Where are you going?" Chase asked, as he saw Harvath get up.
"I'm going to follow him."
"Are you nuts? He knows what you look like. If he even feels you on him, it could blow this whole thing."
"He won't feel me," Harvath reassured him. "He won't even know I'm there."
"What am I supposed to do?"
"Stay here and watch his building."
Chase shook his head. The decision felt impulsive to him. It was a huge risk, and he couldn't begin to fathom what Harvath thought he might gain from it. Heading downstairs, Harvath climbed back out the rear window and came around the side of the building. Very carefully, he headed up the street after Tretyakov. Most carnivores have a finely honed prey drive. It is the instinctive impulse to hunt and capture their food. The better the hunter, the better it is able to sense when it is being hunted. It was the same for human beings. Most people, though, had deadened themselves to their instincts. They had stopped listening altogether. When their gut told them something was wrong, they rationalized the warning away. When the danger finally made itself too obvious to ignore, it was often too late to react. Humans who hunted other humans had a highly developed prey drive. They could sense the presence of other hunters long before they could see them. Chase had been right to warn Harvath. What Chase hadn't fully learned yet, though, was how to mask the signals that other hunters pick up on. There was an energy and intensity that took over the moment the prey drive kicked in. As the hunter locked onto his quarry, it was like projecting a tractor beam. The key to staying hidden was to unplug the beam, to turn it off by denying it any energy. It was a rather esoteric process. Chase jokingly referred to it as the Force, and while Harvath didn't have a term for it, the best explanation he'd ever found for it was in a book about Zen mysticism. Essentially, he removed his ego from the process. The hunt was neither good nor bad. Its outcome would be what it would be, and was therefore out of his control. The ability to remove himself was what made him such an effective predator. Combined with the skills he had learned from the old man, He had risen to the very top of the pyramid. He was an apex predator, a hunter of other hunters. One of the most important things about being an apex predator was to try not to appear like one. Once other predators noticed you, they immediately took interest and wanted to know what was going on. So, like sheep around the world, he took out his phone and pretended to be looking at it as he walked.